Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a longtime Valley judge remembers his adventures in B-17s during World War II.
The whole group was taking up and gaining altitude, and it suddenly dawned on me the group wasn't gaining altitude. We were going down.
We'll find out how he was wounded and captured and how the seemingly cruel action of an enemy doctor was actually a blessing that helped him get home sooner. It's Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Whether you're listening to us on the AM side at 1 o'clock, the FM 105.9 at 5 p.m., or anytime online at kmjnow.com. You know, the idea is to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they've made. We want their stories to be preserved so we know the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, be inspired by what they went through. And few stories are more inspiring than those of prisoners of war. You heard one last week. We're going to hear another story from an ex-POW today. He's 92 years old, living in Tulare, California. And maybe you were in his courtroom once upon a time. It's Judge M.W. Del Rey joining us today. And let's go back to before you were a judge. Now, you actually had a taste of the military before you even graduated high school. How did that happen?
Well, I was in the Naval Reserve, made a couple of cruises, one on the old Oklahoma, and which was sunk at Pearl, and then a two-week cruise on the Perry, USS Perry. And then I got called active duty, and anyway, they didn't take me, and I ended up going into the Air Force.
And that's how you became a POW, shot down on your fourth mission. But I'm curious about this Navy experience. What was that like to be a teenager in the Naval Reserve and sailing with all these guys who are a little bit older than you, getting a taste of that Navy life for 2 weeks at a time? What was that like?
Well, it was, you learned a lot of words, but yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it very much. It's like the National Guard. You know, we have meetings every week. Once a year, we make two-week cruises, and we look forward to those. A very good friend of mine who I got into the Naval Reserve ended up going to the Naval Academy. Then we talked his brother into trying for it, and he made it for the Naval Academy. So
I'm curious, too, and every veteran that I have on the show, I ask to tell me what he remembers about December 7th and how he found out about Pearl Harbor. For you, it had to be a bit surreal to hear that the USS Oklahoma had been sunk when you had been on that ship.
Yeah, I'd been on it.
Well, how did the news of Pearl Harbor impact you at the time?
I was back in Tifton, I know that much. I know that we thought we could get them in 6 months, but no, I remember that.
And so after that, I mean, you'd been in the Naval Reserve, so they call you to active duty, and I guess people would assume that you spent World War II in the Navy, but that's not the case. What happened?
Well, as I say, I got there in San Francisco at the receiving station, and this old, I'll never forget this old fat lieutenant commander doctor said, you've got albumin in your urine, we can't use you. I'd had poached eggs for breakfast, but I don't know how that worked. But so I went down to the Air Force, to the Army, the federal building in San Francisco, and they said, oh, hell, we'll give you that. We'll take a couple of tests. And then they said, oh, you're in the Naval Reserve? Yeah, well, we can't do it. Then you have to get out. So I go to Los Angeles, and I go to the 12th Navy District, Naval District Headquarters, walk in, and here's a kid on the guard station there. He says, hey, what are you doing? You're AWOL. I said, what do you mean AWOL? He said, well, you're supposed to be in San Francisco. And I said, I went up there, and they bounced me. Oh. So anyway, as I say, I went to work at Vega Aircraft, Lockheed Vega, for just while I was taking prep school for the Air Force test. So at that time, you needed 2 years of college, and I was just short. And I went down, we took that test. It took 3 days to take that test on 7 subjects. They had spherical trig in there. Some guys hadn't even heard of spherical trig. And when we get out of the test, the next day, the guy says, what's the closest way to get to Canada? Let's go there. They don't want us in this Air Force. or Air Corps at that time. Oh, God. Anyway, I finally got called. So
you did okay on the test, I guess. The spherical trig didn't throw you.
I think they must have graded on a curve. but they had, it was multiple choice, and I'm damn good at those. I am just essay type terrible, but multiple choice, I'm good at it because I have the information, but it's getting it out.
Well, I hope you don't have to take any of those anytime soon. So in the Army Air Corps, most guys that I talked to who ended up in that branch of service, they were hoping to be pilots themselves, whether they ended up as bombardiers or navigators or gunners. They wanted to be pilots. Did you want to be a pilot too?
Oh, yeah. I went to primary flying school at Visalia, and on my phone got checked, and they took five of us up that morning. It was the end of the deal, and washed out five of us. I don't know why, because I already had my pilot's license. But if they'd have got me through it, I'd have been dead. So what's the difference, you know, if I'd have made it through?
Yeah, and we'll find out why when we hear about some of your missions. So they decide that navigation was a skill you were pretty good at?
Well, I went back to Santa Ana, and you had to take this test again, multiple choice. There were three parts to it. Top grade was 9, and I got a couple of 8s and a 9. I know they called me in, and the sergeant says, well, we're going to make a bombardier out of you. And I said, I don't want to be a bombardier. I want to be a navigator. And he said, well, you have to go see the major. So I went and see the major, and the major looked at the record. He says, give him what he wants. If he wants to be a navigator, go ahead. I got back with the other guys and found out guys were getting 6s and 7s on that test. But I was, as I say, I knew how to take it. They didn't know how to take the test, and that's the reason I got high, and they didn't.
And why in your mind was it preferable to be a navigator as opposed to a bombardier?
I don't know. I want to be a navigator on B-17 and go to Europe. And that's what happened. I didn't want to get shut down. But I did. Anyway, I don't know why. I know a very good friend of mine from Tulare became a bombardier, and he was the only class of 1938 that I know of that was killed in the war, and he got killed over there looking for me. He said, oh, well, that's another story.
He wanted to go find you because he knew you were a prisoner? Is that what you're saying?
He told my folks when he left, he said he'd find me over there, but he didn't. He got shot down. Jack Russell is his name, yeah. Very good friend of mine.
For you as this young man, and you said you wanted to go over in B-17s and fight this air war in Europe, did you have any idea what that actually meant and what you were actually going to be up against?
No, I didn't know. How do you didn't know? I knew it was going to be rough because we'd already heard a lot. I thought we knew what we were fighting for, but that was it, yeah.
So what was going through your mind as you headed overseas? You leave behind your family here in the States, not knowing if you're going to come back. What do you remember thinking and looking forward to or even dreading at the time?
I was young, remember? We're young guys. Mm-hmm. And we're not thinking about not coming back. We're not. Although I found out from there were guys who were getting down about 10% getting shot down every time. And I said, at that rate, we can't make it. And the rest of my crew said, oh, yeah, we can make it. But you didn't think about that stuff. I didn't think about that. Now, some guys couldn't get to the airplane because they were scared to death. I don't know. I never got scared until we started getting shot at. And that's when I started getting scared. Yeah.
Well, that's understandable. For people who've never been on a B-17 or weren't alive then and don't know what it was like, tell us about being a navigator on that plane, where you sat, and what your duties were.
Well, in Europe, the navigator really wasn't that important. Lead navigator was, and you had to know where you were at all times, so in case you got shut out of the formation and then had to get home. But primarily, you were probably maybe a commissioned gunner. I had a 50 caliber machine gun on the left and none on the right, so... But we had to know where we were at all times, as I say, and other than that, why it wasn't that difficult. If you go to the Pacific, then the navigator is really important.
But for you, if you're in formation, the lead navigator leading that flight has to be on target. Otherwise, you guys just trust him. And then, but if you get shot down, as you say, then you've got to adjust and plot a new course, perhaps, huh?
That's right. Of course, it's go west and you can get home.
And anybody that has driven down the 99, and that's millions and millions of people who have passed through Tulare on the 99, and hopefully they notice, if they're heading north, off to their right, a B-17 with a yellow triangle and a big black K in the middle of it. And most people say, hey, I wonder what that stands for. You actually know what that stands for.
Triangle K, yeah, it was the 379th at Kim Bolton, yeah.
That's the 379th Bomb Group, your bomb group. Kim Bolton, England, is where you flew your missions from.
That's right, about 20 miles north of Bedford.
When you got to Kim Bolton, and this is 1943, still pretty early in this air war for America and Europe, what was it like there? What did you find?
Kim Bolton's the size of about Tipton, if that's large enough. But a little place and just an airport. What was tough was like they'd want to check out pilots for night landings and they'd have to have a navigator on. And that was, we call them circuits and bounces. But that was an interesting little job.
Make you feel like a guinea pig a little bit?
Yeah, that was tough.
So tell me about your first mission. What do you remember about that? How anxious were you for that to happen?
The first mission, I believe, is the one over the Ruhr Valley. On the map, all the aircraft deals are in red. The Ruhr Valley is just a big red moon thing there. And when you hit that, it's before you hit it, get hit by fighters. And then after you hit it, the fighters don't come in and you get you. And I hit that a couple of times, as I recall. And then one time to run to Kiel, which is north, and we couldn't make it there because it was clouded over. That was when we turned back, and there's an island out in the North Sea called Helgoland. And on that island was German fighters. And they attacked us, and that's when my pilot took violent evasive action. It was a little too violent and dropped way down. So wonder we didn't get shot down, because they usually hit guys that are out of formation. But we got back in all right.
That sounds a little exciting. Were you scared a little bit?
Yeah. I think we're always scared a little bit, yeah.
And when those fighters come at you, because of where you are, and you described having a 50 caliber to your left, a 50 caliber to your right, are you firing away trying to get a piece of these fighters?
I had one come through the formation right to my right. All I had to do was fire the gun, because he went right past us. But I thought, if I kill him, he might run into the guys behind us. Well, a couple of seconds, he's gone. Didn't even fire a shot. I hate to admit that. Mm-hmm. I did fire one down below us to the left and saw smoke come out and reported it, and they just laughed and said, forget it. You didn't get him. Anyway, I had one. We were flying in formation, being shot. Flak's coming. You can hear the flak on your, like somebody throwing rocks on a tin roof. And this one airplane broke off to the right out for a while, and it just happened. It was an accident, I know, because all of a sudden Flak came out there and he came right back in the formation. I don't know why. I don't know whether it was later I laughed about it, but I think I laughed about it right then. And I was scared to death and still laughed at that guy. That yeah, was one of the few times something funny.
Yeah, I think that is an odd juxtaposition to be flying and flak hitting your airplane and you could die at any moment and you're breaking out in laughter. That had to strike your crew funny.
You know, I'm not sure I did it then or it was later, but I know it struck me as being funny. To be honest, I really don't know whether I laughed then or not, but I know it struck me funny at the time.
Well, it wouldn't be too long until your duties were no laughing matter. In fact, it turned into a matter of life and death. It's time for our first commercial break. When we come back, 92-year-old M.W. Del Rey will tell us what he remembers about August 16th, 1943, a day that changed his life forever, and the seemingly cruel decision by a German doctor that turned out to be quite a blessing. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest this week is 92 years old. He served as a judge for a quarter century in the Tipton and Pixley area of southern Tulare County. But that never would have happened if he didn't survive some hair-raising moments in World War II. He actually flew his first mission, a raid on the U-boat pens at Kiel, Germany, on July 29, 1943. So that's 69 years ago tomorrow. The very next day, their B-17 bombed an aircraft components plant near Kassel, Germany. And 2 weeks later, they were in the air again with a new pilot, Raymond Bidwell. So you've had three missions and encountered pretty stiff opposition on all three of those first three missions?
Well, yeah. Well, the first two and the one to Kiel, got attacked by fighters. That wasn't that bad coming home. I couldn't say that was a bad mission. But the two or the Ruhr Valley, they were tough. I thought that was rough. And then, of course, my last mission was the one.
So this is your fourth mission. And you've got a different pilot than you had on your first mission.
Yeah, we got Ritter Fred White and Bidwell. Anyway, we took off on that mission. Well, that's the one where we got checked. We were being critiqued and navigation critiqued. And I checked the deal and said, well, we're going to get to the French coast 10 minutes early from what it says on this. And the navigation lieutenants there said, oh, don't worry about it.
So your calculations were a little different than theirs.
Yeah, well, I always thought, I never had been able to check, but it always seemed that we got there, we weaved a little bit back and forth and to take some time up so we could meet our
fighter escort. Well, you know, it's really interesting you say that. The 8th Air Force has a database online that you can search and pulls up all kinds of records. I pulled up the official report on that mission that day to Le Bourget, France. It said, fighter escort accompanied us almost the entire route. 19 of our aircraft bombed the primary target, which was the airfield and depot at the Le Bourget, Paris, France, at 0932 today. The result of the bombing was considered by several of our crews to be good, and our lead bombardier saw his bombs land on the designated aiming point, from which subsequently there appeared voluminous red flames. 22 of our aircraft were airborne, but one of these was designated as a planned abortive, and he turned back to our base upon reaching the English coast. It was the opinion of some of our crew members, especially those in the high squadron, that the enemy fighter opposition was the most aggressive that they have met so far. On the other hand, they were surprised by the meagerness of the enemy flak over the target. For the most part, the friendly fighter support was effective and on time, but there was a lag of about 10 minutes between the leaving of one fighter group and the appearance of the succeeding fighter group at the IP. It was during this lag that the enemy made his most ferocious attack. Approximately 50 enemy aircraft were encountered. Enemy aircraft slipped in through P-47 formation and came in out of the sun. ME-109s pressed attacks to 75 to 100 yards. Attacks were made in groups of four. Attacks by enemy aircraft were made on the high squadron, did not follow through on other squadrons. And it continues. But when you talk about your calculations being 10 minutes different, and this official Air Force report saying a lag of about 10 minutes is what caused the casualties, it sounds to me that's exactly what happened to you.
Yeah, maybe, I guess so. We weren't the only plane shot down. I think there were two shot down that day out of our group.
So what do you remember happening? Did you start to feel something was wrong when you guys were delaying?
No, I know that we got attacked by fighters, but when we got to the bomb run, I got hit on the bomb run by flak on my arm and in my leg. I still think I have a little piece of flak left in my leg. We got through the bomb run, and then I noticed the whole group was apparently taking up and gaining altitude. And it suddenly dawned on me, the group wasn't gaining altitude. We were going down. It just looked that way. I looked back up through the Astrodome and could see the pilot and co-pilot fighting the plane up there. Well, I know then I got back down, and the bombardier's still up in the nose, and he's not working. Then I looked back down, and right next to my desk and back is the escape hatch. I look back there, and here's the pilot by the escape hatch on the other side of it, and on the catwalk right next to it is the engineer. And I get up there, and the pilot had tried to open the escape hatch against the slipstream, and it wouldn't open. I could look down, and there was maybe 6 inches, I guess. I could look through it and see the ground coming up. It kept going. We made a couple of swings. We were in a spin going down. And at the bottom of every spin, I could see the ground. And finally, we hit the ground, I thought. And then I thought I could be thinking if I'm dead, you know. And I opened my eyes, I'm falling. And so I pulled the ripcord, the chute opened. And sure enough, my arms and legs, the right leg just flopped. I saw something going on. I saw the fuselage go in the ground and something else, I don't know what. Then I saw two ME-109s going about a couple hundred yards, maybe 300 yards, and going to miss me. Then they turned towards me for a little while, and then they turned back. Well, I found out later that the report was that the pilot was killed in his parachute. So I don't know whether they didn't see me or what, but they went on to him. Anyway, I finally landed and hit the ground. The bombardier ran up to me, so we must have pulled our chutes at the same time just to be close, you know. Then a German fighter came in and started strafing us, and I told Rader, I said, Wayne Rader was my bombardier, I said, get out of here, he's trying to kill me, not us, me. And so, anyway, Rader looked at him kind of funny, and he left. And many years later, I visited him in Oregon. Mm-hmm. I asked him about it. He said, I don't remember that. I was feeling so bad saying he was trying to kill me and not us, you know.
You carried all this guilt for years for no reason.
Then he goes up on there's a road up there with a bunch of people on it, and he melds in with them.
And you couldn't go with them because you weren't in the condition to move, I guess, huh?
Move. I was bleeding my arm, upper arm, and my leg, upper leg, and my lower leg were bleeding. And the German guards came in a pickup. Two ugly ones look just like guys in the movie. And I'm laying there, and this one guy, they got guns, you know what I mean? And this one guy says, pistola, pistola. I had a 45 under my shoulder, and I was afraid to reach for it. I was afraid they'd shoot me. And finally I said, no. They got down by me. Oh, yeah, okay, give it to them. What's funny, but they picked me up and took me to the hospital. But Rader meets the co-pilot. The co-pilot father had married a French girl in World War I. He had grandparents in Paris. They stayed with him.
Wow.
And Ryan, my co-pilot, he was a very good friend of mine. When we went into London together, he and I, but he could speak French fluently, spoke some free French, and they were as astounded because he could speak such fluent French. But they finally escaped. They got with the underground, and they got a couple of times where they were pulled out of bars just in time for the underground for the Germans to strafe it. Then they got sent to put on an old fishing boat, and it was got pushed down in the bottom of it. And it was stunk terribly, and the German officers came up, and they were going to go down and find him. And a German officer was going to come down, and it was stunk so bad. He said, no, good. They got back to England on that fishing boat. Normally, they go to go down through Spain. That's the only time I ever heard of that. Anyway, that happened.
And that would have been your outcome, too, if you weren't hurt so badly, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I'd have been out of there.
So what happened to you from there?
And I went into this hospital in Paris, and I was there, Hôpital Beaujon, which is a big mall, tall, nine, we were on the ninth floor, right on the Seine River, and I had a whole floor of prisoners. Yeah, and a German doctor put a steel pin in my leg from the knee down, and where the break was, instead of having my foot straight below it, he put a 20-degree bow in it. I came to the next day, and there was a 20-degree bow in my leg with a big cast on it. Well, it turns out that he did it on purpose. I got repatriated because of that. Oh. Yeah, Dr. Honecker.
Your initial reaction is that this guy just really messed me up, but he was actually doing you a favor.
Well, I think that later, because now I had a roommate of mine in the hospital, RAF lieutenant, that was... this doctor did put together five breaks in his lower arm. Beautiful job. You could see the x-rays. They'd already taken his leg, so he was repatriated, but he had his arm good.
And this is, and for everybody listening, I want to set the timeline. This is August 16th of 1943 is when you got shot down.
Right.
So the war isn't going to end for almost 2 years from then.
Right.
So if you had been a POW that entire time, your experience would have been a little different.
Yeah, well, I was in Paris for, April, I'd say, and from August to April. Then two German guards took me to Germany, took two guards. I got a cast on and they took the walker off, and I'm got RAF trousers from some big guy, and they were wrapped around, and oh, it was funny. We're at the train station and waiting, and they took me into the bar and sat me down and bought a beer. The French were giving me V for victory. They could see my collar and stuff. And the German officer was sitting there with a real flashy gal sitting at the bar. And I mean, they had a table, and he was in I don't know what kind of a uniform, but it was really something. He got up and came over there and wanted to know what they were doing with this. The Germans didn't get excited at all. They just said, think of him. He went back and sat down. Anyway, that was that.
Well, I want to make sure I understand the impact of this. If that doctor had set your leg correctly, what do you think would have been different?
Well, I would probably end up going to an officer camp and POW camp that's, you know, like in the movies. Yeah, I'd probably end up going, but through all that time, I was sent from place to place. First one, when I got back to Germany, I went to the Luftwaffe Interrogation Center at Frankfurt.
And how did that interrogation go?
Well, I went into a little old room, 6x12, a small room with frosted glass windows and water jug and a string to pull if you wanted to go to the John. I know there was a guy next door, and we got talking and asked where he was from, and he said, OH-10, and I said, Oklahoma? There's no Oklahoma. That's not right. OH-10? What the hell is OH-10? Oh, Ohio. Oh, God. Anyway, that's funny. And then the German officer came and interrogated me and told me who my CO was and what outfit I was in. And of course, I was old stuff by the time I got there, because it was 6 months, you know, later. I didn't have any information they wanted.
You lived this, so it's not hard for you to describe it. It's just going back into your memory. But I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're hurt. You've got to be in pain. You don't know if you're ever going to get back to America. How did you keep hopeful and believe that you would make it home someday?
Well, the first 6 months or so is the worst. But then after that, you start getting used to it, and you see the Germans aren't going to shoot you. They were not like the Japanese. They treated us relatively good. The only people that treated you bad were like civilians if you got shot down in a town, women and stuff, and SS troops would get you. They were bad. But normally, if you got picked up by German soldiers, some guys didn't get it good, but a lot of them made it all right. It wasn't that bad. The only time I got scared is when we got attacked by bombers, or we were in a train and they were going to attack by fighters and stuff.
American fighters, probably.
Yeah, American fighters. Yeah. I had a couple of situations where that happened.
What do you do in a situation like that?
Well, I was going to hit under the, in the train, I was going to hit under this bench, but there was a guy there ahead of me. When our fighters came through and were strafing, and we made it all right. We got into this big, this is on a train that where we ended up going to Switzerland eventually. But we're in this big marshalling yard. They took the engine away. We're sitting out there in the middle of it, and it's when our guys were bombing marshalling yards. We heard the distant air raid alarm. We heard the overhead air raid alarm, and that's when I was scared. A lot of us were, because we knew we were going to get bombed. We just knew they were going to bomb us. They flew right on over us and went on someplace else. Oh, my God, that was great. I mean, that was great when they went on. Whew. Yeah, I'll never forget that, I guarantee you.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, really helpless feeling. So they kept moving you around. Give me the rest of that journey until you finally became free again.
Well, eventually then I was in a couple of places, barracks with guys. They didn't do anything. We're transferred from this place to that. I finally went to this ag school and college, and at that place we were getting ready to catch the train to go to Switzerland. That's when I first saw our first German jet. They looked up, flying over us, and some guy says, look at that guy go. He doesn't have any props. First German jet.
The ME-262, huh?
262 is what it was. That's right.
And for us now, that's an everyday occurrence to hear the jets going overhead, but you didn't even know such a thing existed, right?
We had no idea that something, I had no idea. I didn't know what the hell it was.
And on a serious note, you ever stop and think what those could have done to your bomber crews?
Oh, why? If they just, Hitler, he held them off for a while before they built them. Yeah, it was his fault. We'd have been annihilated, I think. Yeah, that was, we were very fortunate in that war all the way. I'll tell you that. We were fortunate on the invasion. We were fortunate. Well, you can do what you want to, but maybe God was on our side. I don't know. Of course, the Germans thought they were on his side. Well, they didn't think much of God, I guess.
I like your initial interpretation. Well, it's that time again. Time to hear from some of our sponsors. But when we come back with 92-year-old M.W. Del Rey of Tulare, California, this ex-prisoner of war will tell us how he became a free man again and how he exercised that freedom to become a judge. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with a veteran of the 379th Bomb Group, 526th Squadron to be exact. It's 92-year-old M.W. Del Rey. He lives in Tulare, California, where you can see a 379th Bomb Group B-17 right off the 99 at Mefford Field. Judge Del Rey was a navigator on those planes. We've heard about how he was shot down on his fourth mission in August of 1943. His pilot and two of the gunners on that 10-man crew were killed. Mr. Del Rey was wounded and for the most part immobilized by a broken leg. We've heard about the kindness of Dr. Honecker, the German physician who purposely set that broken leg at an angle so Del Rey would remain in medical care instead of a POW camp. And when we left off, we were talking about his journey to freedom again. I think you said you'd been taken from Germany to Switzerland?
And then we go all the way the length of Switzerland at night and went down to Geneva, I guess it is. Got off there, and then they took us on the train to Marseille. We got there and put us on a little yacht, kind of a ship, small ship, American ship, waiting for the Gripsholm, the Navy, a Swedish ship, to come and pick us up to bring us home. And so we were on the little ship for a while, and then Gripsholm came and put us on, and we came home.
What was that journey like for you?
It was great. We hit the bars, hit three bars. I don't know why, but I was drinking whiskey sours. I haven't since then, but I'll never forget it was me and Bert Shepherd. I don't know if you ever heard of Bert Shepherd. Bert Shepherd was a fighter pilot that got shot down and lost his leg, and he wanted to be a baseball player. He was a baseball player, and the prisoners fixed him a leg, and he used to practice with it. He came home and pitched one inning for the Washington Senators. Yeah. Well, they couldn't use him. The war was still on. We got home because we were repatriated.
Yeah, when was it that you got home?
Well, it was the end of January of 45.
And did you sail into New York City?
We were there for a while, yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is so many POWs have told me that after losing their freedom and experiencing life in another country as a prisoner, to see the Statue of Liberty again had special significance.
You better believe it did. And they had ships come out there spewing water and playing Don't Fence Me In. And, oh, when the Gripsholm came in, it was wild. I mean, they gave us a welcome. It was great.
They knew who was on board.
Oh, yeah, they knew who was on board. They were all prisoners. A lot of them were civilians from Italy. And then we hit New York. Well, first, they said, the guy came to me and said, hey, they're having a party over at the officers' club. You guys want to go? Yeah, let's go. We go over there, and they had a lot of Powers models and Conover models. You know, they were, at that time, they were great. Yeah. And they had them there, and I tied up with this one gal, and I was talking, and oh, it was great. They wouldn't let us go outside, so we had to stay inside. And finally, she gave me her phone number, and the next day I called, and yeah, you live with a whole bunch of people, and we got to go in, and we were with them about 72 hours, I guess, in a lot of different places. Oh, it was great.
You were a bit of a big shot, a bit of a celebrity, I guess, huh?
Well, we got this one place in a big, Roosevelt, a big hotel, and they had a raised place where it looked like the band was at the other end, and we were at a raised place with a circular deal with a bench of people drinking, and then in the middle table, but we were all sitting there, and they're buying us drinks, and we were drinking. Oh, it was blowing and going.
Something tells me that being a free man again and being back in the United States, that you were probably looking forward to seeing some of the people you loved again.
Oh, yeah, sure. They put us on the train, and we started out and dropped guys all the way across the United States and I ended up going to Letterman Hospital. Saw my folks, you know.
In San Francisco. So you needed to go to the hospital. You were still not 100% physically.
Oh, yeah, because they had to re-break my leg was still about 20-degree bow in it, yeah. So I had to get home, and they had to re-break my leg and straighten it. And then instead of making it so my both feet were flat and like that, one of them is off. So when that foot is terrible. I'm walking on the side of the shoe all the time. It's terrible.
So for the rest of your life, you've had to deal with this.
I still got it. Yeah, I'm bad. Yeah, it's no good. Anyway, guys that help a lot of guys are a lot worse than me. I'm relatively lucky. I'm real lucky because there's a lot of people worse off than me. That's the way I always look at it.
So after all of that, and after you finally recover and you're ready to do something with your life, did you feel like you had a different outlook because of everything you'd been through?
I know. Probably I did. I don't remember thinking about it. I didn't have an IQ of a way high. Well, the IQ test showed I did, but I didn't really do. I really wasn't that smart. Those IQ tests are allowed. They don't always give you the right number, I think. They leave out a few things. But because I was since I got home, I made so many stupid mistakes, Seals, that if I had any real intelligence, I wouldn't have made them.
Well, there's a lot of us in that club. Your career in law and the more than two decades you spent as a judge, what was your ambition or goal in that? How did you try to deal with the people who came before you?
See, that's what I got retired out of the Air Force in 48. It was the Air Force then. A couple of months before that, it became the Air Force in February of 48. And when the old judge, Judge Clendera in Tipton, died, the old JP, and they had to appoint somebody. And so they had a big meeting, and a couple of other guys wanted to put their name in the pot. But there's a few of us that were going to go on a fishing trip. We went on a fishing trip, and because I wasn't there and didn't talk, they elected me. So I got appointed by the Board of Supervisors to be the JP, and then I was elected later.
And JP is Justice of the Peace.
Yeah, Justice of the Peace then. Then they came up with the consolidation of the courts. At that time, they had Tipton, and then they had Alpaw, and then they had Pixley and Early Mart, Lila was one court. And they put them all together. So I had in Tipton and Woodville, and I'd gotten all the votes. Whenever I had an election, I had up 80 and 90% of the vote. And the Board of Supervisors, they wanted the other judge, Judge Bryan, to be judge. They didn't want me, and they knew I'd win. I had a small district, but I was getting elected. I was getting the vote. They sent half of it to Porterville, all of Woodville to Porterville. And so I didn't win that. So I was out for 6 years. And then I came back and I told Judge Brown I was going to run, so he didn't run. And I got it, and they gave me back Woodville. It turned out all right.
Well, I was just curious, because when you are a judge, no matter what level, there's a degree of power that you're wielding. And you were in a situation where you were at the mercy of the Germans, and you saw how they handled the power they had over you. And I was just curious if that affected the way you wielded your power as a judge.
I didn't wield any power. I didn't use anything. There were some judges that did, not consciously. Mm-hmm. Did I ever try to do that? No. So when I started out on one case, I decided it based on what I thought people would want me to do. And I'm glad I did, because I never did it again. From then on, it was, I go the way I think is right. If they don't like it, they could get somebody else. He may be worse. But anyway, I felt that way, and that's the way I lived. I knew I had to put all the thought I could in everything I did, because the best kind of a judge is a guy that thinks he's right all the time. Then he could be a good judge. But if you know you're not right all the time, then it is tough, and you have to think every time you do anything. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I was. I knew I wasn't right all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised at all the people today who can decide about things hearing half of the information.
Well, and I don't think you had a wife and kids yet when you went overseas, right?
That's right.
So if you hadn't made it home, that never would have happened.
Never would have happened. That's true. I told them that. We discussed it a couple of times, and it was with a bunch of them. And you wouldn't be here. Yeah, that's true.
How many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids do you have?
Well, I had two sons, Rod and Tom, and then you tried for a daughter, and you got two of them, Karen and Kathy.
So four children, five grandchildren, four of whom are still living. And none of those people would have ever been born, as you said you've discussed with them. And I understand your son, Rod, flew a bomber with a little more firepower than a
B-17. Yeah, B-52, yeah. He flew over Cambodia. One day I was in his little office, and I see that blue, you know what's in the, all the metals come in a blue packet, blue box, you know.
Yeah.
And what the hell is that blue box? It opens the air metal. I said, Rod, what the hell, how'd you get an air metal? Well, he said he flew 17 missions over to Cambodia, and they got an air medal in B-17. I don't know whether they got fired on or not. But somebody said to me, how many missions do you fly? I says, well, if I were a liar, I would tell you 24. But I'm not, and I only got four, and one more, and I'd have got an air medal. Didn't even get an air medal. didn't even get an air medal. Oh, God.
But I bet you got a Purple Heart.
I got a Purple Heart. I sure in hell did. I got a Purple Heart. I guarantee you that.
Of the medals you received, is there one that means the most to you?
Purple Heart, I guess, because I didn't get any medals. I got a POW medal.
You know, I'm thinking back to something you said earlier. You were talking about it seemed that God was on America's side in the war. And I hear your story, and I wonder if you felt God was on your side. You talk about your pilot being shot while he's falling in his parachute. They didn't shoot at you. And then this German doctor twists your leg, so you're going to get sent home instead of in a POW camp. I'm sure there are a lot of things like that, but does that make you feel like somebody was looking out for you?
Well, I've always thought there's somebody up there above. There's something, yeah. Sure. If you don't think that, there's something wrong with you. There's a higher authority, no doubt about it in my mind.
Is that a humbling thought, to think of how close things could have been different for you?
No, I never thought of it that way. Yeah, I'm not that deep. I'm shallow. I'm real shallow.
What did you say that German doctor's name was?
Honecker.
Yeah. You haven't forgotten that?
I don't know why. I don't know why I've never forgotten his name, Honecker.
And if you saw him again, what would you say to him?
Oh, I don't know. I'd say thank you. I saw a couple of Germans that I was, at one time, if I'd have seen him on the street and had a gun, I would very easily shot him.
When you think back on all your experiences, what would you say you're most thankful for, most proud of?
As I told you, I'm not very deep. I'm proud of my life, most of it. I've done things that I guess weren't looked on too good, but I've been honest. I haven't cheated anybody. I don't lie to people. I don't believe in it, and I haven't hurt anybody. I thought I did a pretty good job as a judge. I know I had some people that told me later I did. Some people wouldn't talk to me about it. I had a little different approach.
I know you've been to reunions of your bomb group and experienced that, and I know that you've spent time with other prisoners of war. Do you feel a special connection when you're around other POWs? And if there's something special about that, what is it?
I don't know. You're just in the same boat, I guess. You feel you've gone through the same things, and you know what it's like, and they know what it's like.
Well, I want to make sure that I say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me about what you went through. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know?
Oh, I guess that'll about do it.
Fair enough. Don't you love how a man who's been shot down, wounded, and been dealing with the effects of that improperly set broken leg for nearly 70 years now still has that great sense of humor, not to mention humility, too? That's Judge M.W. Del Rey. It was great to visit with him at Twin Oaks Assisted Living Center in Tulare. I've met a few veterans there. You can see what Mr. Del Rey looks like by clicking on KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Pictures of his time in the service, too. And while we have a few moments, how about a heads up on a couple of weekends you might want to mark on your calendar? I've got the Old Town Clovis Pole Vaulting Championships this coming Friday night, August 3rd, and the Fig Fest at Fresno State on August 11th on my calendar. But if you're into old airplanes, warbirds, turn that calendar to September. On Sunday, September 2nd, it is Open Cockpit Day at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. You can actually climb in and see where Mr. Del Rey was in that B-17 when he got shot down, because Castle will have a B-17 open that day. So many historic planes will be open for you to explore on September 2nd. That's a Sunday. It starts at 9 and runs until 5. Active duty military get in free. A family of four is just $30, and they'll have a bounce house and model building in addition to the great food and extremely rare airplanes. And what if you want to see some of those warbirds actually fly? In that case, head to Paso Robles on September 29th, a big air show at Paso's airport that day. They'll have a P-38, P-51, and a B-25 like the one Jimmy Doolittle famously flew, all up in the air on Saturday, September 29th. Active duty military get in free for that special day, too. General admission will be $20. You'll be hearing more about both of those events here on KMJ in the weeks ahead. I just thought I'd give this audience a little heads up, because I'm pretty sure it's right up your alley. That's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.